But more than just taint is at issue in this case. This case is really a study in inconsistency. It focuses on Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 42, the Texas Class Action Rule. That rule is virtually identical to, indeed it is derived from, Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 23, the Federal Class Action Rule. And there are many Texas Court of Appeals cases holding that the federal interpretations of the federal rule are persuasive when it comes to interpreting Texas Rule 42. Yet in this case, we see a Texas court and a federal court apply what is supposed to be basically the same rule to a virtually identical set of facts and come out with diametrically opposite conclusions.
Except didn't the federal case, at least the federal judge that was working on this, give a lot of emphasis to the fact that it was 49 different states as opposed to one state?
Well, Your Honor, if you look at the issues that we're taking issue with, particularly whether common questions exist in this case, the federal court, looking at that in isolation, said there's no way there are common questions here. You are correct that when it came to the predominance analysis, that the court did factor in the 49 states. But in looking at the defect issue in the case, which is really the core issue here, the court said there's no way that this is a common question.
If 100,000 vehicles didn't get paint primer, and the allegation was the lack of the paint primer is what's causing the damage, why isn't that?
Well, because, Your Honor, that's not really the issue here. That's looking at the issue as framed from the plaintiff's perspective and only the plaintiff's perspective. What we're talking here is whether the overall paint systems in these vehicles were sufficient, whether they were adequate. Now, plaintiff
says... The court's position that these cars, only some of them didn't have the paint primer or parts of them didn't have paint primer?
No.
Is that Ford's position?
Your Honor, what we're saying here is that it's sort of like I make a pot of chili, and I don't put chili powder in it. And instead, I put in something else, a different kind of spice.
Right.
Now, some people may say, well, there's no chili powder in there, but when they taste it, they say, well, that's good enough. It's the same thing. And you use a different way of reaching the same result, but it's okay. And that's what we're saying here. They're saying that the vehicles are defective because they didn't have spray primer in them. Our position is, yes, but we put other things in there that made the vehicles adequate. But that thing we put in there, the way we dealt with those vehicles, varies from vehicle to vehicle within the class. And therefore, the jury may well reach different conclusions among the vehicles in the class as to whether we did a good enough job on
that. So under your theory then, if the plaintiff proceeds with a certain cause of action and a certain theory, and that cause of action in theory is common among all the possible class participants, a defendant could undermine that commonality by bringing in a defense that argues that, well, things are really different for everyone.
If that's a legitimate defense, which their experts say it was here. I realize the concern that may exist if you just say, well, you know, any defense is good enough. But the defense that we're talking about here comes directly from the plaintiff's experts in this case. Let's look what we're talking about.
Can the trial court address the problem you have by creating subclasses when he tries the case?
Well, no subclasses were proposed here, Your Honor. And given the number of variations that we have in the class here, it is doubtful to me that you could create subclasses.
But the court didn't do that.
He
could still do that, though, approaching the trial.
Your Honor, that's really one of the problems that I think exists in the way that class actions are being approached in many of the Court of Appeals decisions here. And that's where federal precedent and state precedent really have gone off in totally different directions. The federal courts are now saying, before you certify a class, you better look at how you're going to try that case. You better figure out whether you can do this before you go out and notify everybody that there's going to be this class proceeding and you get everything moved on toward trial. That's what the federal court did. It went forward and it looked at this and said, you can't, or there's no way to do this.
But I take it you disagree with the federal judge's decision in Louisiana that she found that there were common issues.
The judge said it was conceivable to her that you could find common issues in the case.
She really focused on predominance.
But that judge said that the common issues that the judge in this case found were not common, made that specific finding. The defect issue and the knowledge issue which are the two key issues here, the federal court judge said were not common issues in this case. Diametrically opposed conclusions on that.
Your issue really is there's, you don't really complain. There could be subclasses. I mean, there was a plant somewhere in Ford's business that used the same paint scheme for hundreds of cars. You just don't think that they ought to include with those 100 cars, the 100 cars that were produced at a different plant that used a different formula for paint.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, there are groups of vehicles. You are right. If you look at this in small pieces that and may have had the same paint system.
And depending on the value of the damage for having failed to use paint primer, it might not be economically feasible for an individual plaintiff to mount the kind of technical case against Ford for just the amount of money involved. And so this is the type of case that would fit the parameters of class action to allow a number of some representatives of a larger class that would then make it worthwhile to pursue this claim against Ford Motor Company.
Well, Your Honor, it seems to me that what you're really talking about here is something quite different. I don't agree with the proposition that individuals can't mount these claims. Individuals have mounted these claims. The reason that plaintiffs are saying this is so complicated is because this huge class that they tried to bring the claims with respect to. It is not clear to me under the Texas DTPA where a plaintiff's counsel is guaranteed reasonable attorney's fees if they bring the case that these cases aren't mountable individually. In fact, they have been brought. Now, let me turn to the predominance requirement in this case.
These cases have been brought in Texas?
Yes, Your Honor.
And none have been up to the appellate court?
No, they have not, Your Honor. The courts of appeal, we believe, and the trial court also erred at the predominance finding, as we noted earlier. Now, plaintiffs try to pretend otherwise here, but both of the courts below have made a firm finding that in this case there would need to be individual trials with respect to the individual named plaintiffs, that the class, the common issues trial, is not going to find liability, is not going to resolve issues really for anybody. Some court of appeals in this state have said that ends the analysis. Some say you've got to have individual trials for all of the class members. It's not a class. There's not predominance. Others have put it in terms of saying that the common issues must be the object of most of the efforts of the litigants in the court for the predominance requirement to be satisfied. I respectfully submit that if in a case like this, there have to be thousands of trials on individual issues before anybody's claims are resolved, the vast majority of the effort is going to be on those individual trials, no matter how you cut it, and the predominance requirement, therefore, is not satisfied. Now, the utter lack of predominance in this case, I think, is revealed if you look at the individual claims. Let's look at the named plaintiff's claims here. The first one, Mr. Sheldon, he bought a Ford truck. He said he bought the truck after he saw a television ad starring Bill Cosby, which touted the paint features of the truck. Now, nobody else, none of the other named plaintiffs, say they ever saw that ad. This is unique to Mr. Sheldon. A couple years after he bought the truck, he saw some paint problems, but he waited for 5 years before he went into the dealer and asked the dealer to do anything about it. The dealer said, look, I'll make you a deal. It costs a lot of money to repaint the truck, but I'll repaint your truck for $200. The guy said, fine. He did that. And the truck was repainted. In the deposition, he said he didn't have any more problems with it. He said, in fact, it looked a lot better than most other six-year-old trucks that were on the road. He totaled the accident, the truck in 1993 after he drove it for 104,000 miles. Now he wants to get paid back the $200 that he paid as the compromise to get the truck repainted. Now, the individual issues here are enormous. This Bill Cosby ad, he's the only named plaintiff who said that he saw that. But somewhere along the line, for a trial, a jury is going to have to determine what the story is with this ad. Was it a misrepresentation?
You wouldn't have to have that to recover, would you? I mean, the fact that if you bought a car that was not painted properly in appeals, you wouldn't have to prove that you saw an ad about the paint to recover, would you?
Well, you have to remember what this case is. It's an implied warranty case, but in his case, the warranty had run out. So therefore, after that, it's a DTPA case. And one of the claims he's got here is, was there a misrepresentation? So he'd have to prove that. His alternative is to prove whether there was a gross disparity between the price he paid for the truck and the value received. Well, that's $200 on a $20,000 truck. That's not a huge disparity. So it's a very individualized issue with respect to Mr. Sheldon.
As you discuss predominance, obviously a related issue is this question of bifurcation and the need for individual trials on various issues. How do you reconcile the language in 42D that talks about the fact that a class action may be maintained with respect to particular issues with Texas law which disfavors piecemeal trials?
I don't think it can be reconciled, Your Honor, and I think that these are the same issues that this Court had in Eiley and in Otis Elevator earlier. If you look at the issue in Otis Elevator, they were looking at Rule 174B, where the rule specifically authorizes separate trials on separate issues. And in Otis Elevator, you were looking at Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure 81B1 that says basically the same thing. You can have a separate trial on separate issues. I think what you have to look at here is rule, what the full 42D1 says, and it talks about when appropriate. And I think this Court should not deviate from its prior position that what that means when they're talking about separate issues is separate claims. I can envision circumstances in a case where a class may have a series of different claims, but it may make more sense to go forward with a class trial on one of those claims first because it may obviate the need to even look at the other claims that for whatever reason are more complicated. And I think that's the proper resolution of
that. Well, does that mean that in Texas we can never have a class action in which the liability determinations, which are common and do predominate, if we assume that that is shown in connection with the class certification motion, that we could never then have the class follow up proving the amount of damage or making their particular claim? Are you saying that we could never do that in Texas?
Well, let me indicate what I think the problem is with the kind of trial, at least, that is being being suggested here. I just talked about Mr. Sheldon's individual.
Well, can you go back and answer my question in terms of that? If under your interpretation of 42 to reconcile it with Texas law disfavoring piecemeal trials, let's say we could try the warranty claims if we could, but not the fraud claim, for example.
Yes.
You could divide it that way.
Yes, ma'am.
But could we ever have a class action, though, that allowed common issues to be determined, for example, with respect to liability, but then have separate determinations on damage?
I think that would be difficult, Your Honor, but I guess the real question there is why should the class action be different? If there's a principle in Texas that you don't have piecemeal trials to protect the interests of the parties in the case, I don't know why a class action could be different.
So that really means in Texas we have much less opportunity for class action litigation than perhaps in the federal system because of this limitation.
Well, first of all, I don't agree with the notion that there'd be radically less. If you look at the trend of federal law, it's been decidedly away from those piecemeal trials because of the way they have turned out and the abuses that I think that have been recognized there. But I think the key here is Texas Government Code Section 22.004A, which says that rules of procedure that are adopted by this court shouldn't change the substantive rights of the parties. And I think what is being said here is that everybody else, if these claims are being brought individually, there's got to be one single trial. You can't slice it up.
What if you had one jury? Let's just say that you really did have 12 good citizens of the state who were willing to see this through. And you did have common issues at the liability end. Would the fact that one jury decided it take care of that problem?
It seems to me, Your Honor, that you may lose some of the problems then that you have with the bifurcated trial approach. And if you had a class that reasonably you could expect a jury to sit through thousands of trials, that may obviate some of the problems. But my understanding of Texas jurisprudence is that it's not the one jury problem. Indeed, I think there's some precedents that say that that's not really the issue. It's the fact that you have bifurcated trials. But I concede, Your Honor,
it's not a gasoline products problem then?
Well, I mean, it seems to me that you can, you know, there are circumstances where there may be a case that is such that you could have one jury do that and perhaps obviate some of the concerns that are raised by the bifurcated trial point. I think the issue here, if you really look at the...
your time has expired.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
We will go with questions, and I have one.
Yes.
Do you believe it's the appropriate standard of review for an appellate court of a class that has been certified by a trial court? How much deference should we give to trial court's ruling as modified?
I think, Your Honor, that the question in this case is fundamentally an abuse of discretion standard. I think that is met here because the rules that are applied here just don't mesh with the facts. And indeed, the rules by the Court of Appeals to make this fit have been changed radically from the common question definition, predominance definition that has been used by other courts.
Under the limitations that you are saying need to be applied in interpreting Rule 42, are consumer class actions possible in Texas?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I can think of a number of circumstances in which consumer class actions would be readily available.
Give us an example, please.
Example is if you have a company that has a form contract that is used with individuals. And it says in the contract we'll have a certain charge, and it turns out the charge is in excess of that. Seems to me that you'd have, again, not knowing all the facts that are involved, but it seems to me that in a lot of instances you'd be able to have a class action in that circumstance.
But if you had a product that didn't work the way it was supposed to, you couldn't ever have that as a consumer class.
I don't think that's true, Your Honor. I think you could have a circumstance where you have just a flat non-functioning product. Same thing was sold to everybody. The real problem here is there isn't a product. Multiple products were sold here, and people are trying to lump all these into one proceeding and force a jury to give a yes-no answer.
Well, if you have one product that's been sold, we don't have the problem that Ford complains about here, and yet the manufacturer comes back and says, well, the reason why your product doesn't work is because you, class representative, misused your product. And you, class representative, did something else that's the real cause of the problem. And then under your theory, doesn't that defeat the class action again? We've got one product and one complaint?
I think it depends on whether there is any basis for the misuse statement that is asserted there. But there's no debate in this case that the differentiations that we're talking about comes from the mouth of plaintiff experts, and I think that's what distinguishes this case.
Thank you.
Let me ask you a question on the practical side. Let's assume that there is no class in this case, and that every person who would otherwise be a member of the class nevertheless goes ahead and brings a lawsuit against Ford. Why would that scenario not be more problematic for Ford?
I don't think, frankly, Your Honor, there would be much of a difference there, because I think with the individual issues that exist in this case, those trials are going to will be fairly complicated as it is, because you're going to have to reintroduce a lot of the evidence in those individual trials that would be in the common issues trial to start with. When we start talking about product variations there and have to explain why the product is okay because we use a different spice instead of chili powder in there, it's the same old story you're going to have to use in that second trial. So in terms of burden on Ford,
not unless you lose it in the first trial, and then you'd be stopped from trying to relitigate as to the same formula as to the other series of cars.
But, Your Honor, that's exactly the point. Then what you've done is you basically, by granting this class certification ruling, the court has granted summary judgment on this issue, without Ford ever having a chance to get to the jury with it, because that jury is going to have to say they're all defective or they're all not defective, one or the other. And if the jury in its own head is saying, well, some of them are and some of them aren't, either if they say, well, they're all fine, they're okay, then there are a lot of class members whose rights have been injured here. And if the opposite is true and they say, well, they're all defective, then Ford's due process rights have been. But the point is, right then and there, the court, by granting the class certification motion, is in essence granted summary judgment for one side or the other. We don't know which yet, because you're never going to get to the jury and have a fully effective presentation of those highly individualized issues. For
you do admit that there is evidence that a jury could conclude as to however many classes you choose to draw out on, however many different products there were, that they were all defective because of this decision.
There is
some evidence of that.
Your Honor, I don't think that there isn't evidence.
The plaintiff has, I have not read the record yet, but the respondent has quoted some memos in their brief that would make it appear that at least some people at Ford saw this as a unitary problem throughout all these different classes of products.
two points, Your Honor. If you look at those memos in detail, you'd see that they deal with certain vehicles within the class. They're not across the board. And the second point I would make, Your Honor, is that plaintiff's expert, at least with respect to some vehicles in the class, said that it is not possible for those vehicles to be at risk under plaintiff's defect theory. And I think
that's my question.
Yeah.
So you're saying on the evidence most favorable to the plaintiff, there's at least some of these vehicles?
Absolutely, Your Honor, because the concessions have come from the mouth of their own expert in that regard.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court. Mr. Stephen Conigo, representative for respondents.
May it please the court. Well, the first thing that we need to get straight is there is no evidence in this record that one of these cases has ever been filed in the state of Texas for an individual consumer. And I think that the answer of why they have not been filed in the state of Texas was what Judge Abbott was asking the counsel for the respondent. These are too expensive for an individual consumer to bring on their own. They're too time-consuming, and the cost is too high. The courts have said negative value lawsuits where the cost is greater than the recovery are the perfect suits for certification.
But this, they'll still have to bring individual suits.
No, sir. I do not believe, Judge Gonzalez, there will be. When we look at whether or not there are common questions here, we don't need to go any farther than the evidence of how Ford themselves treated this class. Ford, and this is the evidence in this case, and their own record said all the vehicles in the class and our class are ones that had the paint primer taken out. Their own records show that. Ford's own records state that the peeling was caused by the removal of the primer from the paint process. Ford's own records show to stop the peeling, Ford put the primer back into the paint process. When the peeling started and the public saw it, Ford adopted a program called the Owner Dialogue Program. That program only applied to vehicles where the primer had been taken out of the paint process. And Ford then would repaint those vehicles. And it didn't matter which plant the vehicle had been manufactured in. It didn't matter what the color of the vehicle was. It didn't matter what the metal on the vehicle was. All of these elements that they say are individual fact issues, and we admit they can be, but when Ford treated this, the evidence is in the record, they treated the people we have brought this class action for as a class. That's how Ford treated the program.
On page 5 of your brief, you give us some statistics. You say that in 1985, for example, 44.9% of the models surveyed peeled. And my first question is, did all of those cars not have primer, or is it 44.9? I don't understand what that's a percentage of.
Every one that Ford was looking at in that survey, they specifically pinpointed the cars that did not have primer.
So not every car that had primer, that didn't have the primer peeled.
That is correct.
Less than half.
Right. Well, at that point in time, at that particular point in time, and then in Texas, where in that survey is broken down between Dallas, Los Angeles, and I've forgotten the other city, I apologize, but Texas had by far the highest peeling rate.
What we can't just say is, I'm assuming the facts are such that we can't say, well, if it doesn't have primer, it's going to peel.
No. We're not saying that. We're saying that the likelihood, and which is the likelihood Ford found, was that it was very likely that it was going to peel. And their own records show that when they discovered that and they knew that, they did not tell the public. Their own memo, which is also part of the record, is we don't want the public to know this because if they know it, there are going to be more claims.
But does that create an additional causation problem on these individual damage trials? In other words, at what point do they raise that the use of the vehicle contributed to the paint peeling? Is that another element of causation that's going to be layered onto damages?
Judge O'Neill, I do not believe so, because that's real important to how we have pled this case. We have pled this case under the DPPA, which is producing cause. We don't have a proximate cause here. It doesn't have to be the sole cause. It only has to be a cause. And the claims process is going to knock out any car that whose paint did not peel. We propose that in the claims process, which will be merely ministerial, first the jury, and I believe one jury can do this, is answer all of the general issues that deal with the common questions. And then after that, we're going to be left with a claims process, and we will ask the jury, do you think the way Ford did this when they made the determination? Ford would roll these cars or vehicles in, they would take out masking tape, they would put it on the hood of the car, and then they would peel it away, and if the paint came up with it, Ford said that the reason that the paint came up was because the primer had been left out of the process. We asked the Ford man, how accurate is that to test that the lack of primer caused the peeling paint? His response, bulletproof. Ask the jury if that is a good way to determine if the peeling paint was caused by the lack of the primer. If the jury says yes, how long does that take in the ministerial process to determine on the peeling car if the lack of paint caused it? Under Ford's own records, 2 minutes. So this idea that there are going to be hundreds of thousands of trials is simply a straw man. That's not going to happen.
How come Texas, as in the GM side saddle case, is not in the national class?
Well, because we don't think that a national class is going to be able to be certified because we think that the law between the 50 states is too diverse, and that is exactly what the Louisiana District Court found. And we said, we think that if this happens to those counsel, and this is outside the record, you're not going to keep it because fraudulent concealment, the way you're pleading it, requires the law of all 50 states to be compressed into one jury issue, and that is impossible. And that is exactly what the judge in Louisiana said.
And why are you suing Link Johnson and Adiba? I mean, why do all 150,000 purchasers get to sue this one?
Because that was part of the process. In the owner dialogue program, they would not tell the people what was causing. In fact, the other evidence is in the case, they would tell the dealers when you would bring the cars in before the owner dialogue program started and after the owner dialogue program started, dealers, you are not to tell them that this is any type of defect, and you're first, and we have an affidavit from a Ford employee saying that this was the process, you are to say, you've got to pay for this because it's outside of warranty. Then if they complain loudly enough, tell them that we'll pay part of it. And if they complain very loudly, then we'll pay for all of it. And that is an affidavit from a Ford employee, and that went to all the dealers like Leif Johnson, and that is exactly what our affidavit...
Leif Johnson gets sued for people who buy from a Ford dealer in Dallas.
Well, for the class representatives that we have, Chief Justice, they bought from Leif Johnson. Two of them bought from Leif Johnson, and that's why, and that was the process that went, was done there at Leif Johnson.
Well, maybe this is just my ignorance, but I thought that the class defendants were supposed to be somebody that had potential liability to everybody in the class, just somebody who might have had liability to anybody.
These issues will be asked of class reps, but they will bind all the class. And I don't think Leif Johnson will be responsible to everyone in the class. I think Ford will be. And I think, did that answer the question? Or
Sort of.
I'm just having trouble envisioning why there won't still have to be separate trials. Some, even your class representatives, some of these people don't even have the cars any longer, so we can't go do the tape test.
I agree.
And then some of them will have differing measures of damages depending on what kind of condition the car was in, that sort of thing. Won't we still have to have mini trials or short trials, but trials nonetheless on the loss of value?
No, because what we did at the trial court, and this is in the record, is we presented a grid. And we said, if you sold the car and if it had the problem at this point in time on this particular grid with this problem, how much did it reduce the value of the car?
But we don't know that that in theory, but the person that actually sold the vehicle may not have followed the grid. They may have gotten more or less than the grid.
Well, that is, we're going to look at pure blue book prices because cars are fungible and they do have set prices under the grid.
But
and
that my point is, someone may have sold their car or their vehicle for more or less than the grid price, so their actual damages will differ from so-called grid.
But if they did sell it for more than less, they were not looking at what they sold it for, but what the bad paint reduced the value. If they sold it for a certain amount.
No, but your gridiron was going to say, well, your car with a bad paint job is only worth $5,200.
The grid says how much off the value of the car the paint, the bad paint, reduced the sale price for particular vehicles in particular years. So if they sold it for more than they should have, then that will come off of what they sold it. If they sold it for less than they should have, that will be added. But it's not
for
a particular price.
So you're saying they get the damages no matter what they sold their car for?
I'm sorry, Judge.
You're saying they get damages without regard to how much they've sold the car for.
If they had a bad paint, and it was a bad paint because of the peeling paint, they can show that in the claims process. That is correct.
And what about the cars that have been sold? We don't know where they are. We can't do the tape test on.
They're going to fall through the claims process. And those people, many of these people, will not survive the claims process. We know that. And they will not be able to get a claim. But this is the only way that they're going to get any recovery at all.
So under the grid, you've come up with a method of achieving some kind of, let's say, mathematical certainty as to what the damages are going to be for the class members.
Yes, but the jury has to answer that. The jury has to find that that is the correct way, that does achieve the damages.
Okay, assuming that, though, actually going to a step before that, if the class goes forward, are the potential class members going to see the grid, and after seeing that, they will choose whether or not they opt in or opt out of the class?
That information will be provided to them when they have a chance to opt in or opt out.
And for those who opt in, they're going to be subject to the grid. If the jury approves the grid, then you just apply the math and everyone knows how much they get.
Yes. Yes. And that way you don't have the specter of problems. And this is basically the way class consumer actions have been handled in other jurisdictions.
Okay. So the only thing that would cause a deviation from that then would be the extent to which Ford or the other defendants were able to prove that, well, really the problem with so-and-so's car is that they didn't take care of it.
Well, then you go back and you look at our particular case. We've got a DTPA case. This isn't a contributory negligence case. And all it has to be is a producing cause. And if the person did not take care of it, and that resulted in its value being not found, well, that will be already in the price.
What do you do with Mr. Sheldon, for example? He's only out $200. Yet your grid may compensate him differently than his $200.
No, he paid the $200 for the paint. And for those people that paid the paint, then you get into subclasses, that will be their damage.
Often certification is tantamount to settlement because trial is not a viable alternative either for the plaintiffs or the defendants. Do you agree that if it's not a settlement class, at least, setting those classes aside, that the viability of trial is an important consideration in class certification or not?
Judge, first of all, I think that's pretty anecdotal, to be honest. I don't know any hard evidence on that, and I've read a lot of this, and I've studied it, and I think that people raise that specter. But we now know in Texas that class actions are being tried. We've seen them tried. They haven't worked their way up, but that is an anecdotal. We've had one tried in Corpus and others tried other places. Now, I don't think, to be honest, that this trial is going to force anybody to do anything except file some certification to file summary judgments and special exceptions, because if some of these people, as they say, the evidence clearly shows they don't belong in the class, well, that's what motions for summary judgment and special exceptions are for. And if the court agrees with that, the court has already granted motions for summary judgment that Ford has filed on certain causes of action. That will take care of many of these problems.
I'm not trying to be argumentative. I'm asking, in the certification process, when the trial judge sits down to decide should this be certified or not, should he or she take into account the viability of an adjudication on the merits, whether it's by motion or by trial to a jury or however? is that a factor to consider in certification?
I think it is a factor, and I'm trying to answer the question. If I'm not, I know you'll tell me.
No, you're saying it may not be so hard in many cases, and it may not be. But my question is that irrelevant to the certification process?
No, I don't think it is. And I think that there was evidence here very clearly in front of the court of how this could be tried as a class. Now, it has never been said that at the time of certification that the court has to have a complete trial plan ready. And I think under what we have and what this court has said in Moyell, let's be honest, as the court was in Moyell, our trial courts only have so many resources. I think there were 70% of them, as y'all stated, don't even have secretaries, less than that have clerks. And to require a trial court at that point in time to come up with a complete trial plan, I think starts interfering with the discretion of a trial court and is putting a burden on them that a lot of trial courts probably cannot handle. But I think that that is a consideration that should be there. And I think that that also, asking a trial court to do this at that stage, ignores how class actions really work, because the class action rule itself states that certification and how a class is certified can be redone, redefined any time up until the judgment. And there are several factors to consider in the predominance question, not just how it's going to be handled. And that also is stated within our rule and the federal rule.
Let's assume that this class certification is affirmed. Why would that not serve as precedent for the following example? And that would be a situation such as a seatbelt defect case or a crashworthiness case involving a particular make and model of car. Why couldn't we have a class certification for every one of those plaintiffs or potential plaintiffs who were in a crash in one of those kinds of cars, certify them for the liability aspect, and then ship them back out for the damages phase?
Judge Abbott, the crashworthiness cases and seatbelt cases I'm familiar with involve personal injuries. And that's where the federal courts have said, in fact, Texas was ahead of the federal courts on this. We said this in the RSR case, which out of the Dallas Court of Appeals, that personal injuries are so serious and that they can involve, they're so important to the individual that we're going to hesitate to certify classes involving personal injuries because they're too individualized. Now, that is exactly what the federal courts and what the cases they cite to you, Rome, Pallant, Pastano, the American Medical Systems case, those are all personal injury cases. And as Judge Posner said in the Rome Pallant case, when you're dealing with a personal injury, you're dealing with something that is totally individualized and is generally a person's health is the most important thing to them in the world, and those are not suited for class certification like a property damage case is. And I think that's the difference.
Mr. McConnell, if I understand the posture of this case, the party's really arguing over the significance of the defective paint. Is that really a significant issue in this, or is it not? And Ford, of course, wants to argue, well, they've got different formulas. Some were defective because no primer. Others weren't defective because no primer. It seems to me that's the argument they're making, at least using your expert, trying to show that, well, different formulas operate differently, and therefore the primer isn't the key issue. Your point is, well, the primer's the key issue. Well, once we get to trying whether or not the primer made the paint defective, once that's over with, is that really all there is to this case other than each individual plaintiff showing up and saying, you know, I had a car that didn't have the primer, therefore give me those damages? Or is your claim really more like a misrepresentation type claim that says it's not the primer's the key issue here? What's the key issue is the cover-up is the key issue. And Ford alludes to the fact that, well, really what's really going on here, it may be primer is one of the issues, but what really is going on here is they're arguing we misled the public, we misrepresented the state of the facts, or maybe we had a duty to disclose and failed to disclose, And because that requires each plaintiff to demonstrate some representation to them or some duty to tell them, that's how come this can't be a class. It seems to me, what you say is a DTPA, but it really isn't the difference in the value of the car they got and what was represented. It really has to do with what was the conduct of the seller in selling this car to the consumer, and that's where the damages come from. And they're saying that's the real issue. And it really is individualized.
Judge, I think that the lack of the primers, the common defect, is the nexus that this whole case revolves around. As their own expert, when I took his deposition, Professor Ratliff, because we each had experts, ours was Professor Sherman, who's now the dean at Tulane, they got Professor Ratliff. I asked Professor Ratliff this very question that you just brought up. Assuming that we can prove that Ford knew by a specific date that the absence of spray primer on vehicles caused unusual paint peeling, does that jury question under 17.46B23, would it be the same for every member in the class? Yes. That doesn't change with individuals. That is the same for everyone.
Any other questions?
Well, let me ask you one. Come back, Mr. Come back. One quick question.
Judge, it's looking pretty comfortable.
I hate to do it when the light comes on, but there are four parameters on your class definition. Model, year, no primer, in essence.
Yes, sir.
That is a little more complicated. And who suffered damage. And that's like the MDL class, and then the Court of Appeals added a fifth one, who allege.
Yes.
Why, if the class were to be certified, why shouldn't it be everybody who bought a car or a truck with those models and years without primer, whether they experienced flaking or not? Why shouldn't it bind all of those purchasers?
It could. And they can request that, and if it does, then all those people that don't have a car with primer and haven't had the peeling are going to fall out, and they will fall out in the claims process.
All right, thank you.
I have to confess to be a little flabbergasted at the suggestion that all of this can be resolved in one trial, because none of the courts below believe that. If you look at the record of the trial court proceeding, the trial court said, once we get beyond the common issues trial, as I, the trial judge, see it, the real Herculean task, and that was the trial court's note, was everything that will come thereafter. And the Court of Appeals said that the trial court's finding, and I'm quoting from the opinion, of common issues only through part of the causation element indicates its recognition that there will need to be individual findings on causation and damages. None of the courts below believe what you're hearing here this morning, and that is that this whole thing can be decided in one fell swoop. If you look at pages 2 through 5 of our opening brief here and really look at the individual claims that are presented here, there is no way that they can be resolved by a single jury in a single proceeding.
Mr. Spicer, let me ask you, do you agree that if there's a defective paint job on the automobile, that it reduces the value of that automobile on the market?
Well, Your Honor, not necessarily. It depends on whether the market has made the judgment as to whether there's a defective paint job. We presented evidence to the court below that the market value of these vehicles, the blue book value of these vehicles, was not diminished. And I suspect that's the reason why Mr. McConnell is saying, okay, we're going to limit this to just vehicles that had peeling. But the key problem with that is, and I think the false assumption that's being asserted here, and again, look at their expert's testimony on it, there's an assumption that if a vehicle peels, it's because of this defect theory that plaintiffs are talking about. Their expert said there are a lot of reasons. If you park a vehicle outside of a chemical plant and you don't wash it very frequently, it's going to peel for reasons totally independent of anything about the spray primer.
Well, will it respond to the tape test the same way? My understanding is the way they take care of that is the tape test.
Let me explain the tape test here, because this is a red herring in all this. The program Mr. McConico is referring to is a program that Ford had started to basically deal with a wide range of issues on these vehicles. On trucks, and those are the vehicles it was used on here, Ford had an owner dialogue program. They wanted people to bring vehicles in with a whole range of problems. So people
well,
came
well,
in...
Well, without getting into all that, I mean, if someone drives their car around a chemical plant, I think is one of the examples you used, and that affects
right.
the paint, will it peel off
yeah.
the tape?
Yeah. What I'm saying is that tape test wasn't intended to address this issue. It was a test that they were using. If people brought their vehicle in, we offered to make repairs to vehicles. So it could be a whole host of reasons why paint would come off. I mean, look at one of the named plaintiffs here. Our expert looked at the vehicle and concluded that, yes, he had a paint problem with that vehicle, but it was a result of his parking the vehicle in the hot sun on a summer day and throwing cold water on it, which you're told not to do. And if you do that frequently enough, you will cause these sorts of problems. I mean, that's the myth in all this, that there are many causes. It's not disputed in the record. Their expert says that. And that's why the courts below are saying you've got to have a separate proceeding to deal with causation issues. That's why they never got to the point that Mr. McConico is talking about here. And
well, you're going back to the central issue. What you're saying is that without primer, doesn't make the paint defective.
That, well, Your Honor, I am saying that, and I'm saying that you're going to have different judgments by the jury on that score with respect to different vehicles in the class.
And it's central to this case, and as a result, because you could get inconsistent decisions by the jury, it perhaps is best to try this in one case.
Well, indeed, I'm saying it's a denial of due process to try it in one case. Because the jury may conclude.
I don't understand.
Well,
I don't understand if
the jury.
How can? It seems to me it's just a matter of timing. It's not a matter of either the paint formula does something different because there is primer or isn't primer, or it doesn't. And it seems to me you're arguing.